I even teach a course in sport history.
Oh.
I had trouble getting it through some of the people who don't like sports. You know, there are a lot of those. But
yeah, but where you have one of those,
most of it's baseball.
Oh, well, baseball is the game. Oh, you know what I mean? Yeah, football and basketball.
They're okay.
But what I mean, in baseball, you can be 5 foot, you can be 4 foot two, and as long as you got the ability, you play. But you be 4 foot two or 5 foot two in basketball or football, you see you later. Baseball is the game, and baseball is, and
it's got such a long history too. It's more fun to teach it because it does go back over 100 years and has developed a tradition and a body of records and statistics which no other sport has. Mm-hmm. Where can you get a record book like The Guide in any other sport? It has so many interesting statistics.
Well, football and basketball are trying to follow them. Yeah, they're going in the footsteps of the thing.
Right.
And making museums.
Sit over here, might be over here.
Make yourself comfortable. Too bad you couldn't bring your wife along. Well,
she wanted to come, but she had some things to do.
But what I mean now that my wife's not home, it would be a little...
She has a lot of fun talking to the wives.
Yeah, that's what I mean, yeah.
She'd enjoy talking to her, so...
What, are you from Massillon?
No, we're from Marietta.
Marietta.
It's right down the river there.
Yeah, it was... I managed in Marion. Marion, Ohio. Marion and...
Hardingstown.
Yeah. His home's still there. I don't know whether it's still there. It was there when I was there. Well, I was there only partial in 1950. I got let go by the... I was let go by the Cleveland Club, and then Joe Cronin called me up and asked me if I wanted to go manage Marion then. And I said, okay, so I come down here in spring training and help them out in the spring training this afternoon. Then I went over to Ocala to pick up the club and went over there. And then McCarthy gave the managing job up in Boston. And my good friend Steve O'Neill took over the job, let his soul rest in peace. And Steve and I were coached together in Cleveland.
I grew up in Cleveland. That's my team.
So Steve, one of the first things Steve brought me in from Marion, and that was about, I imagine, very early in July, and I was with Red Sox from 50 to 54. Yeah. But I managed in Marion. And
I wonder if you could start in by telling me, is this date right, August 13th, 1908 in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, okay. Pretty close. I changed my age so much I don't even know how old I am.
Does it help you out sometimes?
Oh, no, you've got to, no. Age don't mean anything, as long as you can produce a paper. Yeah. An example of that is Satchel Paige. And you see today these boys that like Star Jewel and that first baseman in Frisco. Is he in Frisco now?
Yeah, Willie McCovey.
Yeah, this is the 40. And they hit that ball as far as any young guy.
Let me just check to see how we're coming through. Now, I was interested in this, in your name here. It says George Cyril Methodius.
Yeah, that's correct.
What is your ancestry?
Slovak.
Had your family been in this country very long?
Oh, yeah. My dad came over when he was a young fella. My dad worked 40 years for Joe McLaughlin. I was born and raised in Pittsburgh.
What country did he come from?
You know, at that time...
The Austro-Hungarian Empire?
That's it. I was just going to go through the details. That time, every 10 years or every couple of years, as you teach history, you should know they split up the countries, you know. Like my father and mother. My mother spoke Hungarian, see, because they were my father and mother spoke Hungarian, see, because they cut the country up and it was Hungarian. So they, when they go to the Hungarian school and they come home, they talk Slovak. And when they go, now my first wife, let her soul rest in peace, her mother and father were caught with the German side. So her father and mother spoke German, and when they come home, they spoke, so you know how, you probably know more about that than I do, because you teach history, you know. But yeah, that's the way those
I read about these things. I've never talked to people who have had this experience.
Yeah. Well, my mother and my father and mother could speak real good Hungarian. My wife's people spoke German. So, and I like now, I guess, I don't know how they do it, but I guess the way these Russians are taking over, I think they're teaching Russian, you know, and then they come home and speak their own language, or Polish, or whatever they are. So,
what language did you speak at home?
Slovak. There mostly is Slovak, but we had some neighbors that, spoke Hungarian. My father and mother could speak Hungarian, so they were very friendly through that, you know.
You speak Slovak?
Yeah, very fluently. Yeah, I can understand. My wife is Polish, and my wife spoke very much. Is that on now?
Yeah. Get those lovely
I speak Slovak, and I, in fact, Sunday they're going to have a mass over this beautiful church in on the island for the Slovak people. I think I'm going to go. I'm going to, God willing, I'm going with help. I'm going over because it's a beautiful church and I haven't been in it yet. And if you,
well, is this Greek Orthodox or
no, Roman Catholic? Roman Catholic.
I teach one of my courses Russian history, and I'm very fascinated about the Orthodox Church there.
Well, they're talking about joining together, aren't they?
Yeah, there is. They're not too far apart.
I don't want to bring anything in about the Pope, but this fellow, I think if anybody's going to save the world, I think this guy's going to do it.
Something different.
Yeah, well, that's the only thing I think is going to save. I think there's too many. I think this fellow's terrific, I think. Everybody likes him no matter where he goes, and he's got a lot of courage.
He certainly does.
He's got a lot of courage, and I think I think if anybody's going to save him, I think he's going to have a lot to do with it.
He just looks like an athlete, too, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, he is an athlete. He's built himself a swimming pool, and he skis, and he exercises every day. And
he could probably hit a ball if he played baseball.
He probably did, yeah.
Well, how about your baseball? And how did you break into it? Was it in high school and sandlot ball? Or?
Well, I played baseball ever since. I loved baseball ever since I was young, you know. And I used to go to a grade school and I'd deliver morning papers and evening papers. And then, boom, I'd go on the field. And then on Saturdays, we used to have a team in Pittsburgh by the name of Oakland Rebels, and I was their bad boy. I used to be up there maybe before any of them levels because I was scared somebody would get the bad boy job, see? And I'd fool around there and they'd play and I'd be their bad boy. And I would be so weak when I'd go home from practice and that I could hardly eat, you know. But so
this was a sandlot team?
This was a semi-pro that I was a bat boy with me. And one of the catchers was, this would be interesting, one of the catchers was Leo Gugil, and he was a personal, he was a sparring partner, chauffeur, and everything for Harry Greb.
Oh, boxer,
right? Boxer, yeah, you know, one of the best.
I've heard about it.
Oh, one of the best that ever lived. Oh, he was
in Pittsburgh.
He was one of the best that ever lived, and fought some great fights. I think.
Did you know him?
No, I didn't know him. I never met him. I never met him. I was a young fellow, you know. I told you I was a bad boy, and to be the fellows playing semi-pro at that time, they'd probably have to be 18 to 25. So you see the difference in ages. that I think that the Gene Tani fought him a couple of times, you know, if I'm correct on that. And I think I read an article where Gene Tani says that he learned more from Harry Gribb than anybody.
Yeah, right.
Oh, he was quick. Reddy Mason was his manager, and Reddy Mason was quite a baseball fan. And he used to go to Forbes Field, and he used to stand in the back with some of the spectators back then. He used to get on all those ballplayers, and all the ballplayers, visiting ballplayers, knew Reddy Mason, you know.
Who are your heroes on the Pirates?
On the Pirates?
Wagner?
No, Wagner was, let his soul rest in peace. He was before my time. But Wagner was a coach at the Pittsburgh club when I played in Pittsburgh in 39. I played 1 year in Pittsburgh. And he was quite a character. He would be sitting on the edge of the bench, and all of a sudden he'd say something that was very valuable to the bowling game. You would think he wasn't paying any attention, but
he was thing. Really a good baseball.
Oh, he was a good baseball
man. Aside from being a player, I mean.
He knew what was going on all the time. You think that he wasn't paying any attention, you know, that he was just sitting there just... But he wasn't. He was, him and Babe Ruth and Ty Cobb are the three of the greatest ball players that ever lived. I think that's down in record, isn't it? I'm pretty sure it is.
Wagner talk much about the old days and that year you were there?
No, I don't.
Reminiscing?
No, he never did. I don't remember him. I know he'd correct somebody, you know, try to correct somebody. No, I don't remember him talking too much baseball. But
Max Carey was...
I saw Max Carey. Well, I used to watch Pittsburgh many games, but I was never interested in watching anybody else play ball. I figured I lose time if I go and watch, but I snuck in every once in a while in Forbes Field. Barney Dreyfus was the owner, and Sam Waters was his assistant. But I want to be out playing all the time. I was always out on the field playing, and I love baseball. I love the catch, and one of the best arms that ever. And they try to make a pitcher out of me, try to make a right fielder out of me, but my heart was set beside catching. And you think that the catching, you'd be, a little bit reluctant in getting back there because it is a little dangerous, as you see my fingers. And
how'd that happen?
Well, that's by foul tips, you know, and I never had them corrected.
It's the finger on his catching hand, his right hand, the first joint there is bent almost about 45 degree angle.
Oh, yeah, they've been there. But when I was coaching Kansas City, we used to have the doctor come out to the ball game, you know, they have a doctor there, you know, an emergency happened. He'd say, come on down, I would be playing at night, you know, and he'd say, come on down after the game, I'll put you to sleep in the morning, I'll stretch your fingers out. I said, no. They say it would bother me, but it hasn't bothered me. They say you get arthritis out of it. A lot of people think I have arthritis, so I guess not.
Unusual. Is it bother your writing?
No. Doesn't bother me at all.
I got a finger here, I can't bend that joint. Playing softball, the faculty was playing a group of students, and I was playing third base, and one of my advisees hit the ball, and it's so fast, it's coming like that.
Is that broken?
No, I don't know what happened, I just can't bend it. I can't bend it.
They could fix anything today.
Well, how about your first professional ball? Who signed you up and so on? Remember that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I was in Shenley High School in Pittsburgh, and we had terrific. I don't think we lost a game in 4 years in baseball or football.
And you play football too?
Oh yeah, yeah. Some people say that I was a better football player than I was a baseball player, mm-hmm. And I got to the big leagues. So mm-hmm. judge from that, you know.
Did you play in the line or back?
No, I was a fullback. I could run like a deer, yeah, you know. Yeah. If you know anything about Western Pennsylvania high school football, and in fact, years ago when I was in high school, Western Pennsylvania was the bed of great football
yeah.
players, you know.
Eastern Ohio too, isn't
yeah,
Ohio,
yeah,
Western.
Down in Steubenville. We used to go down to Steubenville and play Ryan and mm-hmm. and South, you know, earliest first mm-hmm. exhibition games, and they used to have some terrific football teams. It's that's in Youngstown.
Mm-hmm. Youngstown.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah, I played football. I picked my junior and senior years, Western Pennsylvania, WPIAL fullback.
Right.
And that's quite accomplished.
That's wonderful.
I went to Bellefonte Academy. I don't know whether you ever heard of it or not. They used to call that the School of 100 Select. And a lot of boys come out of there. And Kiske, you ever heard of Kiske?
Yeah, Kiske Prep.
Yeah, well, Kiske Prep and Bellefonte Academy were right, you know. All you had to do to go to Kiske or go to Bellefonte Academy and make the squad, and you had a scholarship mm-hmm. in any college in the country. Because they turned out terrific football players.
Did you have a chance to go to college, or did you?
Oh, I did go to college. I was in Shenley High School, Jock Sutton, let his soul rest in peace, was the coach at the University of Pittsburgh, and we were playing for the city championship at the stadium. And I guess they were watching us prior to that, but I guess that was it. So Bucky Wagner, he's dead too, died awful young, good halfback. So they picked up Bucky Wagner and myself, and Bucky had enough credits to get into college, and I didn't, so they sent me to Bellefonte Academy for a year. Then I come back, and then I went to, So the summer I was playing summer pro ball around Pittsburgh, and the Philadelphia Cup came to town, and they invited me to go out and work out with them. So I went to work out with them, and they took me to Fort Wayne, Indiana, and I caught an exhibition game there, and that was the end of my college game.
So what year was this game?
That was in, around 27. And then I went to St. Bon. I was declared ineligible on the kind of that catching that game. And I went to St. Bonaventure College after that for a year. And then a fellow talked me into it, a priest talked me into going up there for... That was kind of dangerous what I did, because we played some terrific colleges and I could have hurt my arm, you know. So I went up there until February, from September to February. Then I went with the Phillies. Oh, with the Philadelphia club.
Who was the scout, or was there anybody in particular in Philadelphia that you remember that signed you?
Joe O'Rourke. Sure. I think his son is still living, but his dad picked me up. Sure.
How
did
you feel about that?
Well, I love baseball. Baseball, you know, I had a brother. My brother was the student.
I've got to keep checking this thing to make sure it's going. It turns off when it's finished and it doesn't make a noise. So
my brother was a student. And he was an honor student in Duquesne University, and I was a guy who went to high school and college and went to prep school, and I just made my mark. See, but I always say this. What is your first name?
Gene.
Gene, I always say the Gene is, if I wanted to be a doctor, I would have been a great doctor. If I wanted to be a lawyer, I would have been a great lawyer. If I wanted to be any professional, you know what I mean, I would have been it, because I would have dedicated myself the same way as I dedicated myself to baseball. Baseball was my life, and it still is. And I'm surprised that I have a little bitterness against a lot of baseball people, because I should be in baseball today, because I've done a lot for baseball. I can prove that I've done a lot for baseball, and I helped a lot of people in baseball, you know what I mean? But I dedicate, as I said before, no matter what profession I would have went to college and took up, I would have been great in it, because I would have made my business to dedicate myself to that, to be great, just like I was in baseball.
Well, your first year here was, how about 1928? Do you remember who you were then?
Yeah, it was 1928, I was in Bellefonte Academy. And I come home from that summer, see? And I played with Bellsouver Semi Pro Club, and then, as I told you, I was asked to work out with the Phillies, and they took me on that trip, see?
That was
the starting of my professional, 28 and 29. I even went to the University of Pittsburgh. They took the outstanding freshmen up to Wimber. If you remember the Wimber, Pennsylvania? I don't know where they still go up in the mountains right there, around Johnstown, Pennsylvania. That would be their fall camp. You know, they took the outstanding freshmen. I was one of the freshmen who went there. Do you remember a fellow by the name of Quatsy, All-American tackle?
Jesse Quatsy?
Yeah. Well, we were freshmen together, and Jimmy Clark and a couple guys from Youngstown. Well, we and
pages out of the past.
Oh yeah.
Well, it says here you were the Phillies for 17 games in.
Well, that was in
29.
And then
did you play with a minor league team that year? Or was
well, it? I tell you what happened to me. See, in 1930, I went to spring training with the Phillies. See, I come out of St. Bonaventure, see, and I went right to the big leagues and stayed there. I stayed in the big leagues for years, see. So in 1930, they probably thought I wasn't ready, see. So I went to Buffalo, and I went to Buffalo. I was in Buffalo, Newark, and I went to Kansas City in 30, see. And I finished up in Kansas City. I finished up good. So then I went to spring training with Kansas City in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Then I came back, and they sent me to Springfield, Illinois, in the 3I League, and I was picked as the outstanding catcher there. And then Detroit brought me up, and then I was up in the big leagues.
What classification?
B.
That would be 31 then, right?
31, right.
Who was the Philly manager in 29?
Schotten.
Bert
Schotten.
How'd you like Bert
Schotten? Oh, wonderful, wonderful. I remember Bert picked me up, and he kind of liked me. He liked me because I was an awful, awful aggressive, you know. I had a person tell me once, he says, "You're a Dr. Jekyll, Dr. Howe." He says, "On the field, you make so much noise, that, and then off the field, when you come off the field, nobody knows you're around." But baseball was my life, period, you understand? And I loved to play, and I loved contact, you know. And nobody could get in that plate. They had to dig themselves under me.
Who was Don Hurst and some of Pinky Whitney or some of those players?
Yeah, Pinky Whitney.
We had a school over here last year. I don't know where they had it here. Not pro, all pro school, see. And one of the instructors was from San Antonio, and he mentioned Pinckney Whitney. He's still around.
We were in San Antonio 2 years ago, a year ago last summer, and I went to his house because I wanted to talk to him. But that very weekend, or that those couple of days, he was over visiting his sister in Houston. I just missed it, and we had to keep going.
Well, so let me tell you, ask me who picked me up. Joel O'Rourke picked me up, see? And Joel O'Rourke picked Pinckney Whitney up. And Pinckney was playing for New Orleans. And he belonged to Cleveland. And listen to this. I heard Joel O'Rourke tell this story. And Pinckney didn't have a strong arm, see? And Joe was interested in Pinckney. But he was sitting with a Cleveland out in the stands, and he says, that Whitney can't throw, and this and that, you know. And to make a long story short, when the draft come up, Joe O'Rourke drafted Pinckney, and he's had some marvelous years with the
Phillies. Yeah, he did.
I heard Rabbit Moran, I have to, I always say, may the good Lord be good to them. I heard Robert Moranville say that to see Pinckney swing from center, from shortstop is just—he's just all one picture. He had a beautiful swing. He was a good hitter. I think he finished his career over 300. And he was a good hitter. He was more than adequate third baseman.
I have a figure of 315 in my head here, but I don't know.
That was his lifetime?
295.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
He was over 300 a number of years.
Oh, yeah, he was a good hitter. He had a beautiful swing.
With some other players in that 29 Philly team.
Oh, Chuck Klein. Yeah.
Was Lefty O'Doul with him?
Yeah.
You have any Lefty O'Doul stories?
Well, Lefty O'Doul, he was, you know, John McGraw used to use the Philadelphia club to farm out Lefty. Lefty would make a mistake and throw the ball to a wrong base, and McGraw would send him back to the Phillies, and he'd keep that made, and then Lefty. Well, he. Everybody knows that Lefty was one of the greatest hitters that ever lived.
He kept the club loose, huh?
Well, yes, and Ted Williams always says that Lefty O'Doul was a very good instructor for young fellows, and terrific instructor in hitting, you know. And I remember one of the things Lefty used to, when he was playing, and he'd get in a slump, maybe if he'd go maybe for a game or two, he'd go and wouldn't be able to get a base hit for, you know, maybe 7-8 times a batter, maybe 5 times, straight times. And he always knew what he was doing. You know, when ball players play in the spring training and then they play half of the season, you get a little tired, your hands drop, see? And he knew when he was not hitting that his elbow would get caught in here, see? And what he would do, he would tell a man that was following him, that was on deck, he'd say, now listen, if you see my elbow next to my body, just whistle. And that's what happened and away he'd go. See, fellas get tired and they get a little they're not lackadaisical, but you know, just a little tired, you know, playing every day and every day and every day, you're bound. So that's what was his, you tell the guy and they're hitting the following, and says, you see my elbow, one more, you tell me, and whistle, or give some kind of a sign, and away he'd go again, and he could hit, and he used a top heavy bat. He was strong. Lefty was strong. And he was a wonderful fellow. Oh, he was a great guy. He was a great guy.
How about the Baker Bowl? Playing and well, like any stories about that. You hear a lot of things about Baker Bowl, the right field being
yeah.
Nattled and kind of close.
Cy Williams was there. I happened to be with the Phillies when it was Cy Williams' last year.
Oh,
is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great ball player.
Well, you used to have to pitch fellas different on when you pitched it. You couldn't pitch that ball away from the guys because the guys were on top of the plate to hit that outside pitch, see? You had to pitch them inside, you know. And if you didn't get that extra on that ball inside, that hit that ball out. I remember, I think it was in 29. It had to be 29. Klein and, was it 29? Yeah, it had to be 29 because Klein and Mel Ott were neck to neck, you know, with home runs, and Chuck beat him out, and the ball would beat Chuck out, Mel Ott out. It went up and hit the flagpole, and up above the vegetable. If it hits the flagpole up above, so it's a home run. See. And then if you check the record, you'll see the Philly, we played a doubleheader, and I think the Philadelphia pitchers walked Mel about six or seven times so Chuck could lead the league in home runs. And I think Judge Landis had something to say about that. Yeah, you can check in. I'm pretty sure that Landis had something to say about that.
Chuck Klein was a great home run hitter, when he went over to Chicago, though, he didn't have quite that friendly right field fence.
Well,
he
that
home run out
for yeah, but nobody realized he had a bad leg.
Huh?
He had a bad leg, and he had a Charlie horse. He went to spring training with the Cubs, and he came up with a Charlie horse, and his one leg was black and blue all year. And he couldn't do his work, so they sent him back to the Phillies. And he went back to the Phillies and started hitting that ball.
So you think it was his health, too, was a factor?
I think that I would have to say that because Chuck was strong. He could hit him. You fool him on one pitch, and then he'd come back and hit the same pitch out of the park. I saw Chuck hit home runs sitting in a chair. Fool a left-hand pitcher, and he'd get down and sit, and then he'd hit. And hit the ball of that fence, you know. But he was, you still got to be strong, you know. They say that left field, the right field fence, yeah, the right field fence, but everybody had a crack at it. All those left-hand hitters. So you can't take credit away from a guy if he hits 50 home runs or if he hits 45 home runs in Bakersfield. Everybody had the same shot. All those left-hand hitters had the same shot. So, give credit where credit is due. Chuck was a strong guy.
That's really
and a wonderful fella, too.
Who was the catcher? Is that Davis?
Davis, and we had a marvelous fella by the name of Lirian. And he had such an arm that if he threw and hit you between the eyes, he couldn't hurt you. But he had such quick wrists, he could pick men off. And he was a marvelous catcher. He was a Al Lopez type of a catcher. Smart as a whip, see. He knew all of it. And a wonderful fella. And an off season in 29, he lived in Baltimore. And him and Eddie Romo were good friends. And they were going out to play golf. And he was going to meet Romo on the corner. A certain street on the corner, you was going to meet with Rommel, and what happened? A truck coming down a hill and it lost control and ran and drove him through stone wall, and that's the way he died.
Yeah.
Oh, all those guys were great. Yeah, we had Frisco Thompson, Tommy Thevenaugh, Denny Southern, Sweetland, Willoughby, Phil Collins.
Fidgety Phil Collins.
Yeah, he went to the Cubs later on, yeah. He had, I remember I used to be in the bullpen, so because I didn't do much catching at the I was a bullpen catcher that he would, and I'd finish up the, and the field would be in a bullpen. I want to go back to New Orleans, I want to go back to them. After the 4th of July, he found himself. He had finished up strong in the 1930, he had a good, I think the next year he had a good year, and then he went to the Cubs, you remember? And then he pitched good ball for the Cubs. He was a Polish boy.
Is that right? Collins?
Yeah, yeah.
Changed his name,
huh? Oh, this guy, that Collins, that left-hand hitter for St. Louis was Polish.
Oh, Rip Collins?
Yeah, I'm almost sure he was. Yeah, yeah. He was strong. He wasn't so tall, but he was tucky. Oh, him and Medwick.
Did you draw very well that year in Philadelphia? 29? Of course, the park couldn't hold too many, I guess.
No, but I never heard them complaining about it, you know, like some clubs, the league had to hold them up, you know. But no, they drew the, I think they made ends meet. Yeah, Mr. Baker was pretty shrewd.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about 1930 then?
30?
That was the year you were in. Danville?
That's the year I was on Cook's tour. I started on Buffalo.
Oh, yeah.
Went from Buffalo to Canada. From Buffalo I went to Newark, and from Newark I went to Kansas City. They optioned me off, see. And they optioned me off, and then I, in 31, as I told you, I went to Kansas City. Then they had two experienced catchers in another AAA, and they sent me to the Class B League, and I was picked as the best catcher in the league, and Detroit bought me. I had a terrific year.
What'd you hit, do you remember?
312, I think. See if it's anything.
You wouldn't have, this just has your major league years.
312 I hit, and I was picked as that, the best catcher in the league. And we got in the playoffs, and I think we were in the playoffs with Quincy, and I broke my thumb. These are all crooked, but there's a scar right there where it went through. And I caught this two games in the playoffs, and I had to go home because I was through for this year.
Did they play night ball there that year?
Oh, yeah.
Was about the beginning, yeah.
I think the beginning of base, yeah, I don't know. I guess it was. That was in 1931. But yeah, we played nine baseball.
How'd you like that? It was kind of an innovation.
Yeah, I like. I was a good minor. As my record shows, I was a good minor league hitter. But I rather played catch two games in the daytime and catch one at night.
Some of those lights weren't very bright, were they?
Oh. It
probably gave the pitcher an advantage.
Yeah, well, I think when you play night baseball, you go from a low, if you're a low ball hitter, you go to a high ball hitter. Because that low ball is hard to pick up at night, you know. And then that ball high, you hit the high ball better.
We're still living in Pittsburgh these years, these first few years in pro ball.
Oh yeah, I lived in Pittsburgh till 1950. Yeah, the way we come down here, my boy that was in high school and he signed he was an outstanding high school player, and he signed with Boston Red Sox. And during the winter, the kids around the neighborhood would pick up sides and play touch football, and he broke his leg so bad that he had to stay out of baseball a whole year, you know. So then somebody told me, it was in the fall of 1950, and somebody told me that if I took him to Florida and let him bathe that leg in salt water, you know, that it would strengthen him. So I come down here, and I've been down here ever since.
Sarasota, you came to that?
Uh-huh. I've been down here since 1950. And that's due to the fact my boys, they told us that his leg had healed better and bit stronger. If he, and he used to bathe it pretty near every day, at least every other day, go out and just, you know, get out salt water.
What did you do in the off season? Did you work?
Yeah, I worked. Yeah, I worked. I always, I could have had different, you know, I could have had some jobs, but I always wanted something. I always wanted on construction because I love outdoors, and I thought being outdoors and on construction and you know, you do some hard work, and I'd keep myself in shape. I'd run back and forth from work, you know, and stuff like that. Yeah, I work in the fall.
Much, were you a hunter or fisherman like so many?
No, I was. I never went for that hunting and fishing. I always try to keep myself in good shape, and you know, well, that's a good way to keep in shape. But I always wanted my boys to enjoy themselves. So as long as they enjoyed themselves, I was happy.
How about Detroit in 32?
32? Yeah, I went to spring training with Detroit, and I had an outstanding year. And I thought I'd stay up, you know. And when the season started, the year before, Haywood had a bad year. Muddy Rule was there. Muddy Rule opened up the season catching. I caught a game in Washington, and then they put Haywood in. And if you check his record, I think he made one error that year. And I'm sitting on a bench, and they said, "Well, kid, you can't learn nothing here." So then I went to Montreal.
You're still Detroit property?
Yeah. Oh, I was a Detroit property. Yeah. I don't know how many years. In fact, I remember when Landis
freed all those players.
Yeah, and I thought I was going to be in that thing, but I wasn't.
Okay.
A lot of fellows got made free agents. Landis made quite a number of free agents.
Mm-hmm. It was Bucky Harris manager?
Bucky Harris was the manager in he came here in 1933.
Oh.
In 1933, they brought Greenberg up and all those guys.
Who was 32 the manager?
In 32,
I was thinking Harris was there then.
Well, Bucky Harris was there in 32,
yeah,
wasn't he?
I think so.
32 and 33.
Cochran came over 34, I guess.
34. Who in the world was the manager in 32?
Was Dale Alexander the team that year?
Yeah, he was my roommate in spring training.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Big slugger, wasn't he?
Oh no, he was there in 32, yeah. Oh yeah, Bucky Harris was the manager. Bucky Harris, he was the manager, and Dale Alexander was the first baseman, and Charlie Gehringer was the second baseman and the auxiliary first baseman. Ball get hit in the hole, and Nelly could all like, "Come on, Charlie," and Charlie would be there, and Charlie, what do you know?
You mean Alexander just didn't cover any ground?
Well, he didn't cover as much ground. He knew he had an auxiliary first baseman there. Charlie would be up there, and he'd Charlie throw the ball. Well, Charlie was, I think Charlie was the best second baseman that ever lived, as far as I'm concerned. He could do everything.
Mechanical man, huh?
Yeah.
Great hitter. Well, it's so effortless, I guess. You didn't appreciate how good he was. Roy Johnson with the team yet, or in the outfield, who was it?
Yeah, Bucky, Roy Johnson, and Gerald Walker, And who else?
And Harvey Walker. Or maybe he was gone by
no,
then.
No.
Jojo White?
Pete Jojo Fox. White came up, yeah. Jojo White. Yeah, Jojo White was there in 30. Yeah. Was that 32? Yeah, I remember Jojo White breaking in against Lefty Grove. And he had a good day against Lefty Grove, and they put him in, and away he went. Yeah, I remember.
Not many people had good days against Lefty Grove, huh?
Well, yeah, Lefty was about, well, he had a good day against, they put him in against Lefty Grove in Philadelphia, and he had a good day, and from then on, you check his record, and he was there ever, he was in center field, I guess.
That was just the building of a real fine team, wasn't it, those years in Detroit? And
33, they had those guys in Beaumont, Pete Fox. Mm-hmm. Auker and who else did they bring up from Beaumont? Greenberg came up from 33 and
Marv Owen may have been.
Yeah. Opening day, they made a deal for Harry Day, and they took Dale Alexander off their bench and put him on. Bucky Wagner was always for defense, you know. And Harry Davis was a terrific fielder, little guy. But Dale Alexander was a good man to throw to. He was about 6'5", I guess, and you couldn't throw the ball over him, and you couldn't throw a low ball to him because he could reach out. But he didn't have much to his right. But being with Charlie Gehringer, Charlie Gehringer just played those hitters like nobody's business.
Who'd you have as a manager up in Montreal? How'd you like it up there?
Oh, wonderful.
Those Canadians support the French Canadians, yeah, support the team and
baseball. They love baseball up there.
You're the Maroons, or the Royals.
Royals. Mm-hmm. And we were fighting Newark neck to neck. Newark had that good baseball team with Johnny Murphy and Rosar and all those guys, and up to the 4th of July, I remember we played a doubleheader against Newark in Montreal, and they beat us a doubleheader, and then they went out, and I don't know, finished the game. So finished that year, about 8 or 9, 10 games out in front. They had a terrific, they had, they had I think Marv Owens was on that team. Marvel was on third base, Dixie Walker and Saul Skager on second base. And who else? I think it was. They had a terrific ball club.
This is before the great team of 37.
That's
which
right.
Is even
yeah,
greater.
I was just going to say that year you're talking about, they had a just as good, if not better, club than that. Yeah. They had Hargraves catching. He was another all-experienced catcher from Cutler, Pittsburgh. And I think they had a shortstop, outstanding shortstop of that year. Dixie Walker was there. He had a great year. Johnny Noonan's on first base. Oh, yeah.
You mentioned the and then Landis Fried, that Detroit covered up, and you thought you should you might have been among them. Mm-hmm. Do you really feel that the farm systems, the many teams that developed them, were keeping probably a lot of people down that other clubs might have used?
They had. I guess I you know what I mean. It's a hard thing to say, but. Like that St. Louis had so many good ball players.
Well, they had three AAA teams.
Yeah.
How are you going to play all those players? And the Yankees did too, I guess.
But they got rid of you when your option was up. They got rid of you before they could lose you, you know. Especially that Branch Rickey. Branch Rickey was a great... Branch Rickey, as far as I'm concerned, was the smartest baseball man that ever lived. Well, his record speaks for itself.
Did you have any dealings with him yourself? Or?
Well, when I was in high school, he sent me a telegram. And he wanted to sign me up. And I talked to him one day in Pittsburgh, and when I talked to him, and just as even made me feel more certain of what I just told you, that I thought he was the greatest baseball player. Talking to him, you know why he was the best baseball man, because he knew baseball, he knew how to... And here's what I can't understand. The baseball today, they're spending all kind of millions and millions and millions of dollars in baseball. And here's a guy that, like Branch Rickey, he didn't care. When he told his scouts, he didn't tell you look for catchers or look for pitchers or look for outfield. He says, sign anybody up that can run and throw. Because there's only one fellow that gave you that good speed and gave a good arm was that the man above. And he was a very religious man, and that's true. As long as you can run and throw and a boy likes the game, they can teach you the other stuff. But they can't teach you how to run fast. They might improve your step or so. And they can't improve your arm, you know what I mean. The man above's got to give you two of those two things. And I don't understand why the owners today don't go for that minor league, go for developing ball players like Rickey did.
They went the long ball.
Pardon me?
They went the long ball.
What do you mean by that?
Home runs.
Well, yeah, he went for long balls, but he...
today, that's his emphasis.
Oh, yeah,
much on power hitting, you know, right?
Well, if you can hit, they'll find a place for you to play. And if you can hit that long ball, you got it made. They'll find a place for you to play. But what I mean, you got to develop, I can't understand, let's say they lose money in the minor league. But I guess they do lose a lot of money, but you still got to develop ball players.
Was there much instruction in any of these teams you played? Were any of the managers or coaches give young players tips here and there? They have to
Not like they do today. Baseball players today should be... Young ball players, and let's put it this way, young ball players have more instructions. They got everything, just like in football, they have a specialist for this, specialist for that, and, you know. And in baseball, the kids get everything. They got everything. They teach them everything and stuff like that. It was a little tough when we were breaking. Not like today. Everybody bends over backwards to help somebody.
A kid who gets a big bonus to sign is making more than some of the old timers there.
Oh, yeah.
Had that problem in the old days. I would think that would develop some feeling within the club that wouldn't be really healthy for
us. Well, what you just mentioned, that happened up in Boston with that Antonelli. You remember that pitcher? Mm-hmm. Johnny Sain was ruining all kind of games, and here comes a kid in there.
$125,000.
I don't know what he got for him, and then they put him on the ball club, and I think they had to raise Johnny's salary.
Players making twice as much as a manager. So how long did you stay with Montreal?
1 year. I was on option there from Detroit. Detroit optioned me up there. So.
And then what happened after that?
Well, then they they sent a bunch of us down to Beaumont. Then I broke my shoulder down in Beaumont and went into my home plate. I was out half of the season, and then next year I went to Hollywood.
How did he happen to hit you and broke your shoulder?
I guess he just run into me, you know. And I thought I was through.
How about your throwing?
Well, that's what I thought. When I went to Hollywood the next year, Oscar Witt was our manager. Eddie Holly was our manager in Montreal.
Eddie,
you asked me that.
Yeah. Is he the old pitcher, or was that some other Holly?
I don't know what the best player. He was a nice guy. Shaughnessy was the general manager. He became president of the league later on, you remember that?
How was Oscar Witt? I came to the manager.
Yeah, I played for Oscar Witt in Hollywood. And that was 34. And Hayward, I think Hayward got hurt, and they brought me up from over there, and I stayed in. I caught a few games that year, and after Hayward got hurt, then they sent me to Milwaukee. I went to Milwaukee about as light as you know. I had a heck of a year in Milwaukee, 1934.
That's the year the Tigers won the pennant.
Yeah.
You were down in Milwaukee.
Yeah, and at least brought me in to help out that year. But they figured I wasn't ready, and sitting on the bench wasn't doing me any good. So they sent me over to Milwaukee, and I...
That was the year with Billy Sullivan, huh?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that year.
Pardon me?
Tell me a little bit more about that year, if anything. Alan Sullivan was the coach of the manager.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Well, when I was out in Milwaukee, I caught Braxton, I can remember this like it was yesterday. That's why I say... I feel like I just come out of high school. Nothing seems to... I don't know how to explain my feeling, but I don't feel any different like I was just out of high school, you know, or just back home in Pittsburgh. But I'm going to tell you that I remember this because I think I joined the Milwaukee Club on July the 5th, and I caught Braxton, and I was on a Saturday. And we won the ball game, and I can even remember the score, 4-2. And I'm sitting in a clubhouse, and Al Southern kind of comes along where I was sitting after the game, and I was getting ready to get dressed. And he pats me on the back, and he says, listen, we got a fella here that nobody can catch. Can you catch a knuckleball? I said, I can catch him. And you remember Presnell?
Boris Presnell?
Yeah, you've got a good memory.
Cot, did they call him Cot?
I don't know whether...
Cot Presnell?
Milwaukee was doing business with the St. Louis Browns. And they were going to send Presnell to San Antonio because San Antonio was one of their other farms. And when I told Southern I can catch anything, and you can check that. You can check this. And because records don't lie. So I caught Presnell. The next time he caught, and I think he won either 8 or 12 games from July the 6th. Now, I don't know. But anyhow, we were fighting in Minneapolis for Bonnie Bush for the pennant. And he was responsible for it because he won those ball. And they were going to send him to San Antonio. And Mike could catch a knuckleball.
How'd you do it?
Well,
little gloves you had then.
Well, no, it was on the contrary. I used to, the way I caught that knuckleball, a knuckleball that breaks high, it don't bother you because that's a ball that's either easy to catch or it's hit. The hitter hits it, but a knuckleball that's hard to catch is the one that comes and goes down. So I used to get down as low as I could, And then I used to get a big glove, and as old as one I could, a soft one, because a knuckleball would hit you here and hit you here, and if you had a hard glove, it would bounce away. So, but if you had something soft, it would go in there. So I was very lucky to catch a... I could catch a knuckleball. You check my record in 1940 with the St. Louis Browns. And I caught Johnny Nigley, let his soul rest in peace. Fred Henney was the manager. Fred Henney was a wonderful guy, one of the nicest guys I met about. Oh, he was a terrific man. Oh, he's a great man. He was, and his wife was just as terrific as him. And I caught Johnny, you can check my record when I was at the Browns. And I don't think I had over 5 pass balls. Now, you check that if you want. And today, fellas catching knuckleballs, they have 5 pass balls in one game. And Johnny Nigleen had one of the best knuckleballs I remember. But that Joe DiMaggio could hit that knuckleball. He could hit anything. We were playing the Yankees. We beat them though. We were playing the Yankees, and Joe had the cycles: a home run, a single, a double, and a triple, and a home run, all on knuckleballs. Really, that's all they had to look for, you know, if you had that power, and the Joe could hit that knuckle.
You really had to supply your own power with it?
Yeah. That's
as well as time it's perfect.
Yeah. But Nigley can throw that. He went, he had a couple, several years, real good years with that knuckleball.
He was in the minors quite a while before he made
that's
it.
That's right,
yeah. I used to get the Sporting News in those years, and I used to study those box scores, and I...
Did he go from St. Louis to Detroit?
No, he checked that here.
He went from the Browns to someplace in that few years.
Where was he from?
He was someplace from out west.
Johnny Newman.
Nebraska.
Remsen, Iowa.
Yeah, temporarily.
He died in Lamar's, Iowa, in 63. I guess that's probably near.
Where did he go from the Browns?
Washington in 43.
Yeah, that's... Oh, now I cover... They had... In Washington, they had about... and Farrell was the catcher there, and every day he caught a knuckleball. He had Wolf, he had Nigley, he had Leonard.
That's right.
And I think they had a little left-hander. I can't think of...
Yeah, Hefner, Mickey Hefner. Yeah.
Right.
I know seeing
you've got a good memory.
I remember seeing a picture in the Sporting News of all those 4 people in one picture making that point. They're all knuckleballs.
Yeah. I think Farrell could catch that knuckleball.
But you didn't have a little bigger glove.
No. Our gloves.
Not like Paul Richards with that great big thing.
No. I couldn't use that. I could use that glove. I'd get the oldest. When you're catching, your gloves are the best when you're ready to about to throw away, and that's the glove that you use because it was so soft. See, and the catcher was low as you can because you could see that high knuckle. I could see that high knuckleball, but the low knuckleball is, and it would bother you. And if you was down low, you could block it. But I could catch an knuckleball. I could catch. In fact, Fred Haney made a deal for me because to catch an England.
Did you ever catch any spitballs or illegal spitballs? Or a little late for that. Some illegal ones, maybe.
Well, a lot of fellas are throwing it today, and I think that mostly those fellas that lose a little, their fastball straightens out. They put something in front of
them. Why shouldn't they legalize it?
Well, it's a dangerous thing. Though even a pitcher don't know which way it's going, you know.
Yeah.
When Chapman...
Ray Chapman.
Kowalewski, wasn't it?
Carl Mays.
Carl Mays, or something like that. I don't know whether that was due to that or not, but Was that the one they eliminated?
It was the same year, but Mays didn't throw a spitball.
They didn't stop with that year, was it?
That was 20. It was, I think, the year after that. They livened the ball up and slowed the pitcher down by taking away the least pitches.
But when they abolished it, but the guys that were making their living on it, they could finish their career with it.
Yeah. I talked to Roger Peckinpah, who was playing shortstop for the Yankees that day that Mays hit Chapman.
Uh-huh.
He's had a direct line with the pitcher throwing into the plate, and Mays threw underhand and scraped his knuckles, I guess. He said that ball, which he made Chapman, was a strike. Mays did brush back batters, but the one pitch that killed this guy happened to be a good pitch, a strike, and Chapman just crouched over the plate and froze.
Peckinpah was a manager. Well, he hired me. Peckinpah was manager, and Slotnick was the business manager at Cleveland when I went over there.
Right.
And Peckinpah was the manager, and then Boudreau was the first shortstop. And Peckinpah went in the office, and Boudreau took the job.
What do you think of this young kid Boudreau, 24 years old, becoming
a manager? You know what that is. That's you have some kids that are 21 years old, and they have a mind of a fellow that's 30 or something like that. And Boudreau was one of those fellows.
He was a natural leader type.
And not only that. But he was a great ball player. I would have to say that when I was a Boudreau for about 10 years. That for about good 4 years. There have been better shortstop for a longer time. Follow me now. There have been shortstop for maybe 8 and 10 years, but there was nobody that was any better, I don't know, in baseball, any better than Boudreau was defensively or offensively. Boy, he was a good clutch hitter. Awful. And he could make that play. Yeah, I said Boudreau for about 4 years. There was nobody ever lived that had any better years, defensively and offensively, than Boudreau.
You went up to Pittsburgh in 39,
Big
season.
Chuck Klein came over there in 39, too.
Was Johnny Rizzo with the team?
No. Yeah. Oh, Rizzo, yeah, he was with it. Yeah. He would, he didn't...
Was he a hard player to manage and coach or get along
with him? Well, he wasn't having a good year, but, you know, ball players are like actors, you know. They're temperamental. Mm-hmm. When they're going good, they're all right. And, you know, a ball player has a tough life, but what a ball player does today is history. He's got to look for tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Well, you know what I mean. Ball players have different temperaments, you know.
Huck Geary wasn't with you in that year.
Who?
Huck Geary, the shortstop.
No, we had Larky Vaughn.
I got a bunch of Pittsburgh scrapbooks for those years, and one year, I'm not sure, may have been 42, 43, during the war, I guess. They got this terrific young player from the association. Huck Geary came up to play shortstop.
I remember him.
He got all kinds of publicity. He just fell flat in his face.
But Johnny Rizzo had a good year when he first came up. You know, the funny thing about that, I'd say that Branch Rickey, he had Slaughter, see? And Slaughter and Rizzo were at Columbus the year before, and the Pittsburgh club was interested to Branch Rickey's surprise, they thought they'd be interested in Slaughter. And they were interested in Rizzo. And, you know, and they made a pretty good deal for Rizzo. Then I guess they were looking for a right-hand, well, right-hand hitter, yeah. I guess. But Rizzo, I think when he first came up in 38, had a good year.
Yeah, I think he did.
And then in 39, he fell by the wayside. And I remember I was with this friend, and I didn't, and we were struggling. And we're in Chicago, and Dizzy Dino was in Chicago, and he, you know, I couldn't hit Dizzy in the Texas League. Nobody could hit him. But after he hurt his arm, I caught the first game against Chicago, and I got two hits out of Dizzy, and I caught, that was on my birthday too, and I caught the second game. Then we went in the first division, but I didn't catch a game up till then. And I always kept myself in good shape, and I run, and the guys would say, "Why do you run this?" So half the year's over, and I got an opportunity, and I did the ball club a lot of good. But we finished fifth, I think, that year, fifth or sixth. But we got, after we got Chuck Klein, we went up to the first division.
That's Pye Trainer, then.
Pye Trainer, yeah.
How'd you like him?
Oh, wonderful. Oh, wonderful. I think the Pye Trainer's the best third baseman I ever saw. This guy in Baltimore, what's his name?
Brooks Robinson.
Yeah, you know, I think, whoever you like, I think I have to lean towards Pye Trainer, because Pye Trainer could run, and Pye Trainer, I guess you could put both of their names in a hat, which one you'd pick out you'd be satisfied with. But I lean to Pye Trainer.
Is Paul Wehner still on the team?
Yeah, he was there, yeah.
See,
Paul Wehner, Lord Wehner, and Rizzo was our outfield.
Because these stories about Paul Wehner's drinking, you know much about that? They say he couldn't hit unless he had something on his
I tell you one thing, and I sincerely say this. They say a lot about Paul Wehner drinking. I have never saw him take a drink. But I saw him hit that ball like nobody's business, though.
I've heard one story. They say he finally... they got him to quit, you know, and then his average went back down. So
I was there then. In 39.
They had to let him drink again, so he went
back
up.
Yeah, that was in 39.
Is that right?
I think that was in 39. But if somebody says that Paul Wehner, I have to say I never saw him take a drink. When he never, one good thing about Paul Wehner, he never took anybody with him, you know. Mm-hmm. He never hurt the ball club. Yeah. The only guy he hurt was himself. You know? He never hurt the ball club. And they have this Clemente there, which is a legend there and everything. And all you hear about Clemente, and why, my goodness, and Paul Wehner.
That was before television, though.
Yeah, I guess it was. What the heck? Paul Wehner played that right field well, like you couldn't get no double on him.
That's
he
right.
Played it well, and he threw that ball second base, you couldn't get a double on him. Mm-hmm. I don't know who's that Paul. I like Paul. He was a one. Both of those Wehner boys were great.
Was Maurice Van Robes with the team?
Yeah, he came up later on. He went to Boston in the deal. They both come up about in 39, and Gustine come up that year too. Gustine, when he first joined the ball club, I was his roommate. We were roommates.
Okay.
Gustine was very successful very successful businessman now in Pittsburgh.
Did Van Robes had such credentials when he came up, you know, and he never seemed to, never realize him, did he?
He never lived up to his potential. Right. Another big right hand hitter come up. Elliot. Bob Elliot.
Yeah.
He had some good years.
Yeah.
They expected more out of Van Robes than they did out of Elliot.
Yeah.
that's the way it comes sometimes. The guys you don't expect. See, some ball players develop, and other ball players, they get so far and that's it. I've seen ball players look like they're going to be heck of a ball players, but they go right to this point, and that was it, and then the other guys improved.
Had you been in the Detroit organization up until they went to Pittsburgh?
Oh, no. Let's see what, no. In 30, they got rid of me in 30.
You're with them in 34.
34. And 35, I went down to, 35, I went, let's see, I went to, oh, I got back in 35 in Kansas City, too, from, after I was with Milwaukee. Then I went back to Kansas City, and Kansas City sent me to Fort Worth, and that was in 36 and 37. I was with, Tulsa, and, no, 37 I was with Shreveport, and 38 I was with Tulsa, and 39 I went to Pittsburgh, and I was up ever since. From 39 to 72.
Did any big league club own you during those years, or were you the property of those teams?
No, I was with independent.
Mm-hmm. How'd you like the Texas League?
Great.
Summer, hot August days.
Oh, yeah, I loved it, though. I love it. That's good for you. You could throw a ball underhand, overhand. And they used to send guys down there with bat. Schoolboy Rowe come down there. Paul Dean come down there. They had sore arms in their arms. He loved pitching in that sun, you know. It's terrific.
It was hot, though.
Oh, yeah. And we played all day baseball, mostly all day baseball. Uh-huh. Especially, I was with Beaumont. Oh, my goodness. It would rain about 1 o'clock or 12:30, and it rained like mad. And you say, boy, you're going to get a day off. Boy, the sun would come out, and you see that heat coming off. Boy, it was terrible. Well, you get used to it. I like hot weather. I love hot weather. I like hot weather. And that's good for you. I was picked on the All-Star team at 36, 37, 38, and Texas League 35 in the Association, 31 in the 3I League. When 35, I think some writers picked me as the best catcher in minor league.
Is that right?
I just didn't get the opportunity.
Yeah.
It means I came up with Cochran in front of me. I went to New York Giants with Hogan in front of me. How are you going to push them guys out?
Spud Davis in Philadelphia.
Yeah. How are you going to push those guys? And they keep you because you're a good prospect.
I see. I had an interview with Nick Culp.
Nick, real well. Yeah.
Well, he had some of the same problem. He was a good record in the minor league. Every time he seemed to have a shot at the big time, somebody else got in there. Like, he came up with the Yankees in 25. Earl Combs came up.
Yeah,
so Nick had to go back down. He came up some other year with the Reds when somebody else came up. It seemed to be his timing was just unfortunate.
Well, let me tell you one thing now, and I'm from the bottom of my heart. If I was playing today, and you can publish it if you want to, I would be one of the greatest catchers in the business. If I was catching. And I sincerely mean that. I could throw and I could receive as good as anybody ever lived. They had, when I was a kid in Pittsburgh and I used to play against, I was 17, 18 years old, not even, about 16, 17 years old, and I used to play against the Homestead Grays. And they had a third baseman by the name of Diego. Does that ring the bell?
Yeah, he's in the Hall of Fame.
The
Black Hall of Fame.
And he...
D-I-H-A-G-O.
I don't know. He was a third baseman and pitcher. John McGraw tried to bring him in as an Indian.
Or a Cuban.
Cuban Indian. And they were comparing who had the best arms, him or I. And when those colored fellas used to play, they were not coming to the big leagues then. And they used to say to me, "Kid, you can throw." And I thought they were kidding me. That I had as good an arm as any that hanged on anybody. That I just, now my minor league record hitting isn't too bad. In Milwaukee, when I went over, I led the league unofficially. I wasn't the Earl Webb runner officially because he had the times of bat. Mm-hmm. And I led unofficially. But, as I said,
that broken shoulder then, did that had no effect on your throwing?
No, I'll tell you. After I broke my shoulder in 33, the Detroit club sent me to Hollywood. And we were training in Riverside. And I was taking my time, you know, taking my time. And I don't know how long I was there, maybe 2 weeks or maybe, I don't know how long the spring training was. And we're playing Pittsburgh, an exhibition game. And Bill Vick says to me, "You're catching today." And I said, I knew it was hot. And I said, "I'm either going to hurt my arm or I'm going to stay here." So we had infield practice, and I opened up. And I threw just as good as I could. I used to men on it. But doctors told me that it would never break there where I had a break. If it's going to break, it's going to break someplace else. Because this thing here, they say it's like a plumber welding a leak. And they just, this, what do you call it, that matter or whatever it is. Forms over that, forms that thing that they say, where it's broke now, it's stronger than, you know, but it would never break there. But as of this game against Pittsburgh, I caught against Pittsburgh an exhibition in the spring training season. And I, as I told you before, I said, "I'm either going home or my arm's going to be all right. I'm going to find out today." And I did. I threw just, on an infield, I threw just like I always throw, you know. And then on, I never worry about it.
How did you travel around in the Texas League?
Well, in 33, you know, we had a little depression, you know. Yeah. Well, at first we traveled by, half of the year we traveled by train, and then we'd go by bus the other half.
Were they overnight stops? Right. Some of them would be, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, we travel all night sometimes in the bus.
That must have been kind of warm.
Well, how long this trip was from Beaumont to San Antonio?
Did you get much sleep in those trains?
On the bus, even. Well, the Texas League and the Southern League traveled first class, but they got pinched a little bit, you know, during the Depression, you know. And some of the clubs still traveled by train, you know.
Had pretty good living quarters. And
Oh yeah. Texas League was even the only place the head court. I mean, hotels were that wasn't too bad in the minor leagues. I mean, you hear stories about it. Maybe some places there, but it wasn't bad. What the heck if you're. If you like baseball and you're having a good year, there are things like that that bother you. If you're on a road and you're going to go home anyhow, and if you're having a good year, why, that means so much the difference between the dispositions of a ballpark is the kind of year that happened. Like this kid got in trouble in Houston the other day. With that sport writing, you know, he must have had something on his mind. His arm must be bothering him, and this newspaper man just nicked him at the right time, said the wrong thing, or right, you know, yeah. And he went after him. He's probably his arm. I think things like that happen. His arm must be bothering him. See? And this guy, I don't know what the newspaper man said to him, but I saw it on television. They really went to it.
Is that right?
Yeah, he was
knocking through a wall, I guess.
No, he knocked him through a door. Oh. It was on television. You could see him going through a door.
Did you have any fights in baseball?
Oh, I had a few, yeah.
How about the umpires? have any problems with them?
Oh, no, I got along with the umpires. I always figured this way, what the heck, and ball players make a mistake. And the umpires, I used to get along swell because when a guy would miss a ball, I wouldn't say, hey, you missed that. I said, gee, I said, that ball was, you know, looked like a good ball. And I say, well, okay, you know, or something like that. I'd say, well, we all make mistakes. And, you know, I'd get the next pitch.
You're very tactful.
You know what I mean? You, what the heck, them guys are human. And as soon as you get on the umpire, and the other umpires on the bases see that, and they're going to, you got to be diplomatic, especially when you've got the umpire. And I remember Pip Brass was umpire in the American League, and everybody was on him. And I got along swell with him. If he'd make a mistake, I wouldn't say nothing to him. No use in that. Sometimes you get on these umpires, and the more you get on them, the worse they get. But you get along with them, they give you a break. You don't ask for a break, but they give you a break because you're good to them. You know, human nature is human nature.
Were you were in the Southern League?
No.
Never?
No, but I was in the Texas League in 36, 37, 38, and then I went to Pittsburgh.
I was going to ask about Steamboat Johnson.
I heard a famous
umpire there.
Yeah. I think he umpired a couple of games. We used to go to New Orleans and play, what was it?
The Dixie Series?
No, we used to go in the spring training and play it. Maybe go for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday and then come back. Johnny Gilbert's, Gilbert?
Yeah.
What was his first name?
Larry.
Larry, yeah. And he had two or three boys that played the ball. One went to the big leagues all the way.
How did you happen to go over to St. Louis from Pittsburgh?
On waivers.
Uh-huh.
And Frankie Frisch, he was the manager of Pie Trainer, was the manager, and Frankie Frisch came in 40. And as I say, Nigling was in St. Louis, and I guess they had Bob Swift over there that year, and he was a pretty good catcher, and he couldn't handle a knuckleball, and I guess they figured that we'd get somebody to handle a knuckleball and save Bob's fingers or stuff like that. So I guess Fred saw me on my name on waivers, so he claimed me, and I got to go to St. Louis.
And then the next year to Cleveland.
Next year, the same way. I got put on waivers, and Slapnick brought me over. He asked me, he called me up and he said if I'd come over as a player coach, asking me if they're going to come over as a player coach. So I came over there as a player coach, and then that was in 41.
Did you catch Bob Feller at all?
Yeah. I don't think I caught him in a game. But I did all the warming up and stuff like that. You know, I come over there in 41 and then 45. I was a coach to 45. Then the war broke up and I went back on the active list. No, I went on the active list in 41. The war broke out in 41. Mm-hmm. And I went on the active list in 41. I was on the active list till 45. In the 45, the war was over when I came back. Always come back in 45. Am I right on that?
They've got you down here for a couple of games each year.
I mean, that's when the war broke out in 41, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And they put me back on the active list.
Did you serve then in the...
No, I was 4F on a kind of my knee and shoulder.
Well, did Steve Gromick come up? Was he with
you? Oh, yeah. Steve Gromick and I were terrific friends. I remember when in 41, was it 40 or 41? He came up in 40, I think. And we're playing Washington, doubleheader. And I don't know what we did the first game, and Steve is pitching the second game. And he's in the corner, and he's kind of worried. And I says, what are you, I come out and I saw him, what are you worrying about? Well, you had a nice talk to him. And do you know, he went out and he pitched a heck of a ball game. And we became very, very friendly. He lives in Detroit, right out of Detroit, in Birmingham, Michigan. And Steve would always, Steve and I would always get together after being to order his house. He's got a beautiful home there. But Steve and I became very close. We were in Richmond one year, coming north. We used to travel with the New York Giants, a train out in Tucson, and the Giants train up in Phoenix, and we'd pick up each other and go all the way. So we'd be in Richmond, and Steve got pitched against the Giants. They had some hitters, and they hit Steve like nobody's business, and he come to me crying, and I says, what's the matter with you? You got a sore arm? No. So you got a sore back? No. You got Charlie horse? No. So why? I said, what are you crying about? So the next day, feller went out. He said, a bomb feller. And I said, what's this? Now you see that? That's what happens. He had the best, livest fastball that I ever caught, I said. Steve. The right-hander had no chance, but left-handers, He couldn't get left-handers out. And we tried to teach him a sinker, you know, or something. But he could, but the right-hand ball club, the Philadelphia, Connie Mack had a powerful hitting with a powerful right-hand hitting ball club. And Steve would hit boom down like shooting ducks off. But left-handers, that Washington club, but they had all left-hand hitters. Steve couldn't pitch against him because he pitched sidearms. And he left that hitter, loves that. But we tried to teach him to throw a sinker, but he never, but he was really...